This is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Disagreement isn't new, nor is partisanship. But it's hard to deny our current political reality is different than what we're used to. No matter where you stand on the political spectrum, it can be hard to understand what the other side is even talking about. Alternative facts, equivocation, spin, denial. This isn't just disagreement, at least the kind we're used to. These are separate worlds, separate universes, each with their own sets of facts and values. Today on Dialogue, a look at what we're calling the American multiverse, how it developed and how we live in it. Later in the hour, we'll hear from historian Aaron Astor, sociologist Tricia Bruce, and communication professor Courtney Wright. But first, we hear from a familiar voice, Brooke Gladstone, co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media. After the election, Brooke had the same dissonance many Americans did. What happened? Why? And how can we learn from it? She put forth her observations in the ebook, The Trouble with Reality. Gladstone says people, mainly on the left, woke up on November 9th feeling like reality had fallen from underneath them. But really, Brooke says, there is no such thing as a single common reality shared by everyone. The concept of reality itself is, in large part, personal.
What I mean by that isn't that all facts are created equal. Facts, if you can prove them, are actual nuggets of a genuine all-over reality. The issue is, how do we use those facts? And what I argue in the book is that we filter them foremost, and we marinate them in our values and our histories and our personal circumstances. And then we use them as bricks to assemble a reality that is consistent, that we understand, that we find relatively predictable. And those are the realities that we live in. And although ones can resemble another's in many respects, they are all essentially bespoke, handcrafted.
If that has always been true, what is unique about our current time and place, about this current environment?
It's a great question. I've been puzzling over it a lot. And my feeling is that, well, for one thing, because of our ability now to choose from an endless number of media sources so that our facts are pre-filtered, so that we never have to encounter a contradictory idea or incident that would challenge our realities, we are much more snugly ensconced in them than we ever are before. And of course, that comfort is amplified by all of our social media echo chambers. And then who should come along but someone who has decided that reality is entirely separate from the facts and basically presents a notion of reality that resonates with people who have been consistently lied to by both parties, or a notion of reality that may not bother the vast majority of his supporters who simply wanted to keep their tax rates low. And he says, here is my reality. It is consistent. It may not be something that you can view for yourself, but it's something that resonates with you. It's something that you can believe. I can offer you a picture of the nation, which doesn't resemble the facts, but which is consistent with your worldview. You know, all you have to do is accept what I say when I say it. Forget about what the facts are, because the facts have never served you. I get you on your real level. I get what you feel, and the picture I construct, whether or not it represents reality, resonates with what you feel, and I will be your champion.
I do want to explore a little bit about what you said just a moment ago about the role that social media plays in this, and I realize it is trendy and it's been beaten to death to blame social media for all kinds of problems we have or issues in the society, but it seems like, at the very least, social media platforms have made it much easier for us to construct our realities and in ways in which we don't have to consider that somebody else may be right or that somebody else has a valid view and that everything I, Brandon Hollingsworth, think is exactly right and true and everybody else has aberrant philosophies. Is there a way forward that takes that into account, or are we stuck with what I might consider a broken informational model as long as social media is kicking around?
Well, you see, the thing is, what the internet has done is simply made us more of who we were anyway. And what's broken, or rather what needs to be adjusted, is us, how we consume reality, how much, and I write about this in the book, you know, how much risk can we pose to our universes? Because it is actually almost nauseating to confront information that challenges your notion of reality. That is precisely why so many liberals feel such a profound degree of distress right now, more than they have ever felt perhaps in their lifetime. It isn't because a candidate was elected that they didn't like. It was because, and it was entirely because, I believe, that their entire notion of how the world worked and what the nation was challenged. In other words, their reality, their bespoke, handcrafted realities, kind of imploded, and they were left floating in a sort of void. You know, a lot of the principles they relied on didn't pan out. And so, fundamentally, the problem is not with social media. It's how we use it. It's how we reward those that present it to us. Media is and always has been a business. So the problem begins in our own heads.
Where does the press fit into this environment, Brooke? In The Trouble with Reality, you write that after the election, the press in general began what you describe as a long overdue soul search. I know you and your co-host Bob Garfield have debated that. How do we continue our jobs in this unique environment in which, you know, the credibility of the media is savaged at every turn, trust in the institution is at historic lows? What is it we should be looking for? How do we do a better job in understanding and communicating among these competing realities? It feels kind of like we're having to invent a new Rosetta Stone to talk to different areas, avenues.
Well, I think what we have to do is correct for certain stylistic tics that developed in mid-century. You know, around the 1950s, the dominant form of media came to be the most expensive form of media that history has ever seen. I mean, prior to that, the cost of media would fall down, 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 and suddenly it was huge. Television was far more expensive than any other way we disseminated information in the past. So you needed much bigger audiences to support it. So there was that. Another thing is, at the same time, you were being regulated by the government in a way that we hadn't been during most of the era of print. So what you've got is a confluence of technology and economics and politics that created a big middle and that impelled the media to marginalize outliers, anybody who would threaten or question the national consensus. I know this says, well, what's this got to do with now? But what I mean is, Brandon, this is when we developed our quote, objective style. We were just as selective as we ever were. But now we all agreed, and so we could call it objectivity. That was what the age of objectivity was. Okay, and we have kept to that ever since, because TV has continued to dominate. Well, suddenly we have a cheap form of media again, and the price to entry has gone way, way down. And suddenly you don't have to assemble such an enormous audience as you used to. In other words, we are at a moment when we have to understand that it isn't about the appearance of objectivity, which often distorted the news, and is about every reporter's best effort to be accurate and fair. And by fair, I don't mean a false balance where you give climate deniers the same amount of space as the vast consensus of, you know, the global scientific community. I mean, as accurate and fair as you can be to present both sides, but in their correct proportion. Doing that without a pie chart and timing things out means that people have to look to their own values and their own sense of professionalism to provide the most important truth with the priorities that they apply to it, something that has always been done. But now that the national consensus is broken, reporters have to take responsibility and not hide behind the myth of objectivity and a false balance.
It's interesting that you say that, because I would imagine that the kind of fairness and the kind of objectivity that you're describing, where you just present things as they are without regard for a purely 50-50 presentation, for instance, would be seen among certain segments of our audience as evidence of bias, as evidence that we're being dishonest. How do we talk with the group? How do we talk to an audience that is predisposed to say, well, you would say that, Brandon, this is part of the conspiracy?
Right. Well, you know, there's a large part of that that you simply can't avoid. You know, any word that comes out of your mouth is suspect because people think they know you. So what you simply have to do is support your information and make it as relevant to the way people live as possible. Avoid deliberately offending people in order to make yourself feel brave and like a hero. I don't think it makes you brave to hurl insults at politicians. I think it simply deepens the divide. And there are risks. There have always been risks, and reporters have covered their butts by using neutral language and applying a numerical balance. I don't think that served the public very well. As far as the news consumer is concerned, because you work for public radio or Fox News, they already think they know you. So whatever comes out of your mouth will either confirm or deny that, or perhaps soften the preconception, the stereotypes.
Should we have less of an expectation that conversation will lead to agreement? I feel like it's often pitched that way, it's framed that way in a broad sense, that if we just listen to each other, everything will get better. But that doesn't guarantee agreement or sudden insight or epiphany. What is it that we should come to expect from conversation and listening so that we don't set a standard that we may not be able to meet?
Conversation isn't going to mean anything unless it results in changes on the ground. If the small margin of people that put Trump in office hadn't been lied to by both parties for so long and hadn't seen their opportunities shrink without any concerted effort to adjust for a changing world and a changing economy and a shrinking industrial base, which will never come back. If they hadn't been fed empty promises and had been confronted with the reality that those jobs won't come back, if they'd been presented with programs where that could happen, where their kids would see some opportunity, but not by replicating their parents' lives, if there had been more reality to start with, we probably wouldn't have been in this situation. That's where the conversation begins. But it matters not at all if it doesn't end in positive change.
Is there anything else that you want to add that you think will help our audience understand this, what we're calling the American multiverse, these divergent realities?
I think it would be helpful if people understood how we filter reality, and there are plenty of studies about this, how we simply don't hear things. We don't hear them when they challenge our views. We change our world as little as we can, our worldview, in response to information that we can no longer deny. We are benefited by dopamine when we successfully lie to ourselves. We are wired to move continually in our own little universes. And the challenge of defeating that wiring, I think, is the fundamental challenge of our age, because all the technology now supports it. And again, it's personal. It has to happen inside everybody's head. And if we look inward rather than outward for the cure, you know, collectively, I mean, I sound like such a Pollyanna, but in all honesty, it isn't going to happen unless we are willing participants, each and every one of us.
Brooke Gladstone is the co-host of On the Media, which is heard on WUOT every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Brooke, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Brandon. Bye.
Brooke is also the author of the e-book, The Trouble with Reality, which came out in May. In a moment, I'll be joined by a panel as we continue to explore the concept of the American multiverse. That's after this break. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Our conversation continues. Our thanks, of course, to Brooke Gladstone for that conversation on tape last week and agreeing to speak with us. We're going to move on to a live portion of our program now with three guests who can hopefully elucidate this matter a little bit more. Courtney Wright, an associate professor of communication studies at the University of Tennessee, Aaron Astor, an associate professor of history at Maryville College, and Tricia Bruce, an associate professor of sociology, also at Maryville. Greetings to all of you, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, we just heard from Brooke Gladstone, and I want to pose some of the same questions to get your perspective on what we heard her just talk about. We have established, as part of the premise of the program, and history itself seems to have established, that periods of disagreement are not unique to the American democracy, to the American Republic. And Aaron, I want to start with you because you've studied previous divisions of national disagreement, including the biggie, the Civil War, you know, which were quite disagreeable. Yeah. What is unique about the current environment? We don't even have to stop with the Civil War, 1968, periods before and after World War II. What is unique about what we're going through right now?
Well, first of all, Brooke just hit on something I think really important about the nature of the media in the mid-20th century, controlled by television, regulated by the FCC, which centralized media. We think of Walter Cronkite as sort of this voice of objectivity. And it created a false sense, a false expectation of truth, of understanding truth as what Walter Cronkite says is true. Mm. And so as we move even ever so gradually away from that voice, that sound of reassurance, we feel that things are falling away into an anything-goes world. What's interesting is I think there's a parallel process going on in the political parties in American history. In the 19th century, newspapers and media were openly partisan, as partisan as the most partisan and ideological and outrageous social media today. I mean, we think of Knoxville's own Parson Brownlow, who renamed his newspaper the Knoxville Whig and Rebel Ventilator. I mean, this guy would get in, you know, gunfights in the streets over this. He was not alone. He was one of the most colorful, but he was certainly not alone. And what we call today, you know, fake news and people living in their own bubble, those kinds of accusations were around all the time. I mean, I've seen, you know, people being taunted for getting an election wrong because they never talked to any real people, you know, who lived in a particular place. It's exactly the same kind of thing we've heard after November 2016. What's interesting that's happened, I think, is that the political parties that developed coming out of the Civil War were kind of ideological and regional coming out of the issues of the day. In the 20th century, there was a very slow, gradual shift of the Democratic Party becoming gradually more northern, more urban, and increasingly more African-American, and the Republican Party becoming more suburban and more southern and western. This took a long time to happen. It did not happen overnight. And what that meant was that in the middle of the 20th century, the same time that we had this sort of central media voice, was also the time of this grand bipartisan era, where you would have liberal and conservative Democrats, and you'd have liberal and conservative Republicans. And so it was commonplace that on any major divisive issue, you would have members of both parties supporting both sides of any particular issue. But in some ways, that ran its course by the time you got to the 1990s. Newt Gingrich had sort of finished this off. I mean, we forget the state of Vermont never voted for a Democrat ever, except for LBJ, until Clinton. And many southern states never voted for a Republican until George W. Bush. But now what's happened is you add to this primaries and gerrymandering, and political elections are entirely about catering to the base and winning a primary. And as a result, what happens is the media, our notion of truth becomes who adheres most devotedly to the party line. And those who oppose it are seen as pathological, as unpatriotic. There's something just simply wrong with somebody who lives and caters and speaks outside of that political world. But part of that, I think, is because we have unrealistic expectations of bipartisanship because of what we may remember from the mid-20th century. And the reality is we're actually more like we were in the mid-19th century. I don't think we're close to the Civil War, but I think we're close to that raw kind of hyper-partisanship. And that's actually probably how we need to be, because we have real differences.
I want to talk to you now, Dr. Wright. You study how people communicate and conflict management, two things that kind of crash together in this kind of environment. And I want to turn to the effect of social media, which we talked about with Brooke Gladstone, where people can create these handcrafted realities. The my reality and your reality, I only have to follow the people that agree with me and the accounts that reinforce what I already believe. Is there a way forward that takes that into account, or are we stuck with a broken or flawed informational model as long as social media remains a part of our daily diets?
I'm a little bit more optimistic because I think that the root issue isn't so much social media and its use, but rather our understanding of what social media brings to the table and what we lose, right? So there are certain skills that people aren't cultivating as a result of their dependency on social media. For example, we've kind of created this virtual isolation among ourselves where we're just kind of echoing into this chamber and hearing back
what
we've
said,
right?
Us,
And that isolation is distinctly different from being in community, right? So we're fulfilling our need to belong through social media, confirmation from others who think a lot like us. But in community, we learn things like civil discourse and interpersonal communication and conflict management skills. And that's what's lacking, is that people aren't creating that diverse community. I think on top of that, we have, and Brooke mentioned this, in terms of the tendency to kind of view fact and fiction as being equal. So in our use of social media and all these various spaces that we can acquire information, we find that we've kind of redefined what information means, right? So it's not just fact, but it's factoid and it's blatantly false fiction. On top of that, we have this undercurrent where individuals aren't necessarily equipped to tell the difference, which is a problem
right.
in terms of critical thinking in our education system. But also on top of that, there are other individuals who just don't care. So it isn't just social media. That's going to have us chasing the symptoms. But it's a lack of an awareness of what skills are cultivated in the absence of social media and how an overdependency of that is really undercutting our own personal human development.
I want to mention, too, that our phone lines are open, 974-5050, if you'd like to add to the discussion or have a question. And Dr. Wright, to stick with you for a moment, it sounds like you're echoing something else that Brooke Gladstone said, which is that social media didn't necessarily fundamentally change us. It just made us more of who we are. It gave us a platform that we wouldn't have had 25 years ago to express these opinions outside of, say, writing a letter to the editor of your paper.
Right.
Like, it's just we're more exposed to what people have to say now.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen these things through history. You can look at, the telegraph has been referred to as the Victorian internet. You saw similar discussions in the 80s in this onset of mega malls, right? So people are leaving the public streets. They're no longer safe. Now we're gravitating to the mall environment. And all of those things are changing and shifting how we cultivate community, how we identify our needs to even belong to a community. So I think that we've oversimplified human connection and the diversity that really exists among our relationships, because we've really emphasized similarity. And we see that in, online dating sites, music selection. There are all these things that we choose that we never have to share with one another. Mm-hmm. And that lack of skill development we see manifested, in a very significant and problematic way in our political discourse.
So you mentioned community and the changing nature of community or lack thereof. Dr. Bruce, as a sociologist, I want to talk to you about this. I want to inject in particular a term into this conversation, tribalism. If you would define that for us and tell us how it might be instructive in understanding the divergent realities of this country.
Well, the notion of tribalism gets at the idea that we are essentially encircled by those who share our experiences and our background. And oftentimes, by being surrounded by folks who share that experience and background, it serves to magnify or exacerbate the differences that we may have between ourselves and others. When we think about how we know what we know, it turns out that a lot of what we know is actually not based on even personal experience or discovery. We're really trusting others and our notion, our own notion of common sense in order to get at what we think reality is. And so when we put ourselves in environments, whether it's through social media, but I would argue also it's in our neighborhoods, it's in our churches, it's in our schools. And if we are constantly surrounded by others who share similarities in terms of our race, our class, other forms of background, then that can really give us a sense of what we think is common sense and reality, but in fact is quite different from what someone else may be experiencing down the road.
How do you climb over those walls? How do you make the membranes a little more permeable between those differing or even conflicting realities?
This is the challenge because I think that we tend to trust our own common sense. And yet sociologically, oftentimes we find out that our common sense is in fact incorrect. For example, there's often a misperception that violent crime has been on the rise. It's on the rise for a number of years. We hear fear echoed in media. But then when you look at actually the empirical facts behind that and looking at rates of violent crime over time, they have actually gone down in the last several decades. And so part of what that means is that we have to look to social science. We have to look to empirical data. We have to look to ways that go beyond our common sense and our perception of reality in order to check fact. Now, this is easier said than done because other sociologists have written about the fact that there is something that some have called the backfire effect, which is that you present a set of facts to an individual that actually refutes their understanding of reality. And instead of convincing them of truth, it actually makes them double down on what they think reality is and fight back against it. So this is not necessarily a happy response to that, but it does emphasize the need to both look at empirical facts, data. We have data on our side that can actually tell us stories about reality. And also, there was an author, Ardley Hochschild, a sociologist who wrote a book called Strangers in Their Own Land, that she started researching sometime before the election, but it came out just after the election and ended up being quite relevant. But what she talks about is the need to develop deep empathy and to bridge the wall that might be between different communities in order to better understand one another and have those conversations that cut across not only our individual spaces of preference, but really these structural spaces, these neighborhoods, these churches, these schools, these cities that are in fact systematically and every day in our lives separating us from one another.
Okay. John from Knoxville, you're on the line, and go ahead with your comments for dialogue.
Yes. Is this for John?
I'm sorry, yes. On line one?
I don't know what my... I was the first one to call.
There you go. You're first then. Go right ahead.
Okay, good. A couple of things came to mind that I would like the panelists perhaps to comment on. One is there is a distinction that the writer Madeleine L'Engle made someplace about the importance of maintaining the awareness between fact and truth. And also talking about objectivity, I just wonder how much of an influence Ayn Rand's objectivism has been in the current fray. Thank you for taking my call. I'll ring off now. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for that question. Does anybody want to take that one? I'm not familiar with Ms. Rand's work other than through osmosis from other people. Anybody feel comfortable taking on like what influence that might have in our current?
I think it's more, I'll take it. I mean, I'm not a specialist in Ayn Rand's work, but I can say in terms of influence, it's probably more indirect than direct. I mean, there are a number of people who have read many of her works. There are also some, you know, famous and powerful people like Paul Ryan that have read and have taken influence. But I mean, as his case shows, not everyone is necessarily influenced by her objectivism as they are perhaps by her libertarianism or some other aspects of her work. But I do think, you know, there is this question of fact versus truth is an important one, though. And it's a question, it's a challenge that any kind of expert in any field has to deal with. Scientists have to deal with this. In fact, most recently, some of the Confederate monument debates and all these things and talking about whether they are memory or whether they are history and so on. You can list out facts till you turn red in the face, but truth is different than facts. And truth has to resonate in a deep way that may and often will depend on how you define facts. But it often also depends upon Trisha said before, the kind of, it's a tribal, but the sort of the community of people around you who reinforce your identity, who help to develop sort of who you are. Facts mean something different when they come from one person than they do if they come from a different person.
And you had something, Dr. Wright, that you wanted to interject as well.
I just wanted to emphasize the role that survival plays in the human existence, right? So to kind of go off of what you said, Trisha, about the importance of empathy. Right, I think we really overlook the extent to which we engage in faulty communication behaviors, faulty perceptions, what have you, in our efforts to predict and explain other people's behaviors. So as a result of that, we can overlook how distressing it is physiologically in terms of cognitive dissonance to deal with inconsistency in our thoughts, beliefs, and attitudes. And that's at the really the root of the challenge of attitude change, right? How do we move into that space? But being aware of the fact that when someone starts to dismantle something that we have built in order to navigate the world around us, as that reality crumbles, as Brooke was talking, being left with the unbelievable task of recreating and restructuring that reality while maintaining our self-concept that we've cultivated during that time is very overwhelming. And those are skill sets that we aren't really cultivating in any clear space. And I think that ties to society's increasing tendency to outsource the role of our personal human development. So we're looking to other spaces to kind of feed us what we think we need in order to develop, as opposed to looking inward, as Brooke was talking about, as she said, she sounds like a Pollyanna. But there's so much of an outsourcing, where we're depending entirely too much on other spaces.
Outwardly looking for validation.
And not even just validation, but trusting entire systems for our own development.
Dr. Bruce, I want to come back to you for another sociological perspective here, because at least when I see people talk about it on social media or in the public sphere, people seem to be thinking of it purely along a left-right kind of divide, or primarily along a left-right divide. If you feel this way, then I know who you voted for. If you feel this way, then I know what you support. I know what policy, you know. It feels to me, as an observer of this fractured conversational environment, that the fault lines are many, and they run deep, and they cut across all kinds of various strata that are not strictly partisan. Are we stuck right now in a kind of a loop or a faulty way of trying to evaluate and categorize and understand these conversations, because we're trying to fit them into an old conversational model, left-right, as opposed to something that seems like it has a lot more nuance than that?
Yeah, I think that both things are true, in the sense that we have a society and, again, a media and other roles that force us constantly into this binary. And in fact, we're now, based on data, better able to predict and see consistency along each of those sides of the pole. So in other words, what someone thinks about, say, global warming may help predict what they feel about Black Lives Matter or what they feel about XYZ issue. So we have this sort of consistent stronger consistency at the edges of the spectrum, more consistent ideological sides, both in terms of Republicans and Democrats. But what that masks is this vast span in the middle of folks who have a great level of nuance in terms of how they see issues, and issues that don't neatly fall along to an ideological spectrum. You know, when we're talking about local issues in our city, these are issues that oftentimes we want to find blue or red, but in fact, they're issues that affect businesses, affect neighborhoods, affect individuals as they're trying to live out their lives for themselves and for their children, that don't necessarily fit neatly into this ideological rubric. And the vast majority of people do fall somewhere in the middle. So I think oftentimes we're trying to force people onto one side of the spectrum when the issues are far more complicated than that.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about this, and I was going to save it for after the break, but I want, because this is tailored right into what you were just saying, I'll go ahead and ask. How much data do we have? how many data, how much data do we have right now on understanding this? For you as a sociologist, I imagine we're kind of in the early stages of trying to do the surveying, come up with the theories, create the models to really understand what percentage we're talking about of the American public versus the what Nixon called the silent majority, which you were just talking about, or how deeply these divisions run. How far along are we in understanding, not just begin to create prescriptions for, but understanding where we are in any kind of quantitative way?
Sure. You know, there was a study that was done by the Pew Research Center in 2014, and this would have been, of course, before the most recent election, so we want to keep asking these kinds of questions. But they polled people on a number of different fronts in terms of understanding where they stand vis-a-vis their ideological views and then a number of social issues. And this is where some of this data is coming out in terms of seeing the sides, each side of this being hardened. But in fact, if you look, there's a vast majority of folks, you know, some 55% describe themselves as being more in the middle. And also being comfortable with complexity and diversity. But the thing is that these edges of the polls are the ones that, these are the folks who are the most politically engaged, the most politically active. And this Pew study also asked who were their friends? Did their friends share their views? And oftentimes what you find is that people are existing in echo chambers that exacerbate those same ideological views. So I would say data-wise, you know, we do have a number of really interesting things that tell us, you know, how closely you lie in that each end of the spectrum, and in fact, the vast majority of folks being in the middle. And yet we see the polls having the most power, both in terms of who shows up at the polling place, who votes, and who gets the microphone.
Okay, we'll pause right now for a station break. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. We're coming on down into the home stretch of Dialogue on a Wednesday afternoon. Thanks for joining us on 91.9 FM WUOT. If you're just joining us, the conversation topic today is the American multiverse. Diverging realities, not just disagreement. And we have on the line with us Jane in Knoxville, who's been very patient and hanging on. Jane, go ahead with your question.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in how we could organize a community forum with people who have opposing viewpoints in order to not necessarily agree, but learn how to discuss our disagreements in the public square in a civil manner. And it's a two-part question. Do you think that this is beneficial? And how could it be organized and properly moderated so it didn't become a shouting match, if you will?
I'll talk to our communication professor who studies conflict management and interpersonal communication. I kind of have that, I have an empathy for that kind of question for sure, because when I see it happen on Facebook, when I see it happen at the town hall meetings where Congress people go back to their districts, and it just kind of descends into a melee. How do you avoid that? I mean, how does that, it sounds like almost everybody has to sign a waiver at the beginning. I write 100 times on the chalkboard, I will behave, because there's a lot of anger right now, and it's hard to tamp that down a little bit in order to get to a different kind of conversational plane.
Great comment. I think we need to see more of those efforts in terms of community efforts to promote dialogue across the aisles. So there's a lot of work on how to moderate critical conversations, for example, which is what we would be stepping in here, and trying to ensure that both sides have an opportunity to not only be heard, but to also learn from the other side. And I think also you have to create within that space ground rules for the individuals who are participating in terms of how do we avoid one-sided conversations, active listening strategies, how to build a sound argument, right, so that we can avoid the contempt that has definitely become quite pervasive in these discussions, as well as cruel uses of humor. So not necessarily a long list, but giving people the strategies and then also helping people work through those difficult places. Because what's at the crux of this is that things are at stake, right? There is a lot at stake, and there is a lot of important positions that overlap. So the goal becomes kind of tossing aside the positions, but emphasizing and trying to cultivate the interest. which is where we can see these people who hold an opposing viewpoint as being more layered, more reasonable, and sharing some similarities with us.
All right, Jane, thank you for that question. Dr. Astor, I wanted to turn to you for just a moment because your expertise on the Civil War and its aftermath has put you in the spotlight recently, especially after what happened in Charlottesville and the ensuing discussions about the present and future of Confederate monuments. You're someone who's studied this, of course, and you've been very active on social media, engaging with people who agree with you, disagree with you, or just want to know more. How successful do you feel like your efforts have been in communicating beyond where people already are and trying to move them even a little bit to say, well, it's not what you think it is? That's a tall order, but you've been engaging in it almost every day. How do you feel like that's been going?
I have been. You've noticed. you know, I think it's actually gone better than you might think. I think that I'm actually quite optimistic about the possibilities of reaching out to those. Here's what's needed: patience. That's the hardest part. And I think this is the problem with social media, is that it warps our sense of time and space.
Yeah, it's so immediate.
Everything's immediate. It warps our space in that, as we talked, as Trisha was talking before about who our communities are, people around us, it's given us this strange sense of being in a community with people who might be halfway around the world, who we might interact with every day or several times a day on social media. But it's also warped our sense of time. We expect, not only do we expect to get information very quickly, we expect to convert people very quickly. We expect to get results very quickly if we're trying to persuade somebody. And you have to step back and say, no, it takes a long time. A lot of people, especially with this monument debate, and especially in Knoxville, where I think, you know, the whole Civil War experience here is more complicated than a lot of other places. You know, if you take a step back, and there's a few things you can always do to disarm some people. There's some preconceptions, common preconceptions people have, both Northern and Southern, if you will, that you can help to disarm people. I always remind people that this is not about the 21st century. This is, we're talking about the Civil War. It's about the 19th century. Don't impose our values back then or take those people and impose them to now. You can't pick your own ancestors, that kind of stuff. They're trying to get people less defensive. But, you know, sometimes people will come back later on and you'll feel, you realize that they've developed a more nuanced understanding. They've decided that they're going to check something out that you hadn't thought about before. Not everybody who says something that's frankly absurd or silly online is saying that because they know better and they're just saying that to be a jerk or a troll. I mean, some people genuinely don't know. And you have to have a good faith expectation that at least somebody out there can listen to what you're saying. And if they're going to disagree, they can be able to put up other evidence. But you have to be careful about taking the bait when somebody tries to troll back or tries to hijack the thread. I mean, sometimes you can't help but get it sucked into it, but you have to be careful about it. Because the fact is, you know, broadening your perspective on anything, whether it's Civil War memory, whatever, it takes time and it takes patience. And most of us are not really patient to wait for somebody to come around. But that's really what, you know, taking the expertise that those of us have and disseminating it to the wider public requires a lot of effort over a long period of time.
Okay, Bob is on the line. Go right ahead with your question.
Is this for Bob?
Yes.
I'm Bob. Hey, listen. my question is about risk-taking and loneliness in friendship groups. Of course, I could be wrong in anything, but it seems to me that loneliness is rampant in America, and that people's friendship groups mean a whole lot to them. And all the ones I know have kind of all these friendship groups, which are extremely important to us social creatures. All these friendship groups have political litmus tests that kind of are the lubrication that allows people to converse, and also the glue that keeps the group together. So my long-winded question is, if you're going to go after truth and you're going to look at the other side, in a lot of cases that doesn't seem realistic because it's overpowered by the adhesive qualities of the politics of the group.
Likeness, yeah.
Well, my question is, how does the person do that? How do they take the risk of losing the friendship group?
Well, this gets to another point that we saw talked about after the election. People whose friendships or family relationships were damaged by who they voted for or what they were saying around the Thanksgiving dinner table. This, I can imagine, is a very real concern for a lot of people. Dr. Bruce, maybe you'd like to throw in here.
Sure. This same Pew study that I mentioned earlier actually asked specifically about friendships. And in part, again, we're choosing, just as you say, a litmus test, we're choosing friends based on politics. You know, the study showed that nearly two-thirds of consistent conservatives and about half of consistent liberals say that most of their close friends share their political views. So I think that there's some of that going on. I would also just echo, too, what you said about this very need and opportunity to build those friendships and the challenge that we have in a modern society that does rely so much on building community online or otherwise. There's also a rising level of number of single person households. So we have households even where we don't, we're living alone, perhaps in an urban environment or otherwise, and we're not necessarily building those friendships across lines. And then I would just finally echo on that point, something that Courtney said earlier, as far as thinking about how is it that we bridge differences and build a community with others who are dissimilar to us, and the need to have a conversation where perhaps we have some ground rules about communication across those lines. I would say that in part, you know, sociologically, we look to where community already is, whether it's yoga class, whether it is a religious congregation, whether it is the grocery store, the school. You know, we don't necessarily have to invent new spaces to find each other. We're there. So then it's just a matter of how do we mesh that with a type of conversation that finds common ground through exercise, through parenting, through whatnot, and then politics may come as really a learning and again that deep empathy through conversation rather than a starting point that creates animosity.
Dr. Astor, I want to turn back to you for a minute. I know you're an historian, but I'm going to ask you to look into the future a little bit, or at least give us some guidance here, because as we've talked about through the entire hour, it's not unusual to have periods of deep disagreement, wide division in the American electorate and in the public in general. We don't know what the future is going to hold. I don't know if this is going to be a blip on the radar that we'll all look back on and laugh next year, or if this is going to be the next four decades. I have no idea. But looking to the past, in stitching up our old wounds, how long does that usually take? That can be a pretty lengthy process for us to come back to a position that any of us might say is a consensus.
Yeah, if I think of the great flashpoint moments of the 20th century, 1968 comes to mind. 1919 is another one, both of which were kind of radical moments that seemed to have spun out of control in many ways, and it led to major backlashes to follow. And then things sort of settled down in their own way. It's hard to really say because I think that the there's a surreal quality to the divisions that are there right now. 1968, there was, of course, the Vietnam War, but there were very, very serious social issues that were being debated about civil rights, about gay rights, about women's rights. In 1919, also many of those same issues, labor as well. Nowadays, the particular issues being debated are not so much. That's not what we're arguing about so much. It seems to be sort of a broader sense of pose or a broader sense of identity. It's almost we're arguing at a meta level about, you know, who's being faithful to what it really means to be American, who is not.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel it feels something's very unsatisfying about the way it is right now. And I think what's going to happen is, you know, the Trump administration, of course, you know, every day there's some new controversy of sorts. That's like nothing we've ever seen before. And so we have no way to know what'll happen next week. We have no way to know what'll happen next year. But I get this sense of people wearing down from it. There's a sense of kind of fatigue.
Wondered about that.
Yeah, I think there is, and on both sides. I think there's like, come on, like, can we get back to something like normal again? And of course, here it is. Now we have hurricanes. Now we have North Korea threatening, you know, who knows what, and you know, all these issues. But of course, they're not going away. And I feel like, you know, we're arguing as if we're stuck on November of 2016, as we're trying to explain the election, and we're not. That's over now. This is 2017. And as we look at that and we stop, you know, arguments that I see so much that are based around explaining the 2016 election, which, of course, the president himself is obsessed with it, you know, we'll never go anywhere. But if we're trying to go for the future, I think we're getting a little tired of a lot of this arguing about nothing, really. A lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is arguing about nothing. And I think that we probably will retreat back to something that's a little bit more practical. Hurricane cleanup would probably be a good starting point. For us to kind of come together and talk about things that are practical.
It doesn't fall along ideological lines.
Not most of it, yeah.
Right. Dr. Wright, I want to come back to you as we get close to the end of this hour. You and I spoke last December. You were a guest on Dialogue, and we talked about how to have these conversations, particularly tied to like the holiday season when we see our families and we're in different groups. I want to check in with you now, 10 months down the road. Are you more or less optimistic that those kinds of conversations are practical, that they can be had? What's the old phrase? Solving a problem, the first step is admitting you have one, which is a tough thing for a lot of people to do. 10 months after our conversation from last December, are you more or less sanguine about having these productive conversations or getting anywhere?
I'll echo Aaron's comments about fatigue.
Yeah.
So I think that's the greatest hindrance to these conversations, is that people have created even greater divides, right? Because they tried to broach these topics before anything happened, right? Before Trump took office. And now that there's a new headline each and every day, there's a general fatigue and I think an increasing fear and uncertainty about what the future looks like. And that is causing people to almost avoid these conversations. So we're almost developing an unhealthy new form of political correctness as it surrounds these issues, where it's, we're really not going to talk about this.
Right.
When really, that's the exact opposite of what we need to do. And it isn't about talking initially to persuade people or to change attitudes, but we aren't talking to understand. And
yeah.
That's what's necessary. And to force the conversation to a point beyond the kind of empty rhetoric, be it about patriotism or about being Democrat or Republican, but about the real issues that affect all of us. And that's my concern, is that the fatigue is contributing to those issues.
Brooke Gladstone says she thinks things are going to get messier before they get better. Do you agree?
I do.
Do you think so?
Because I think that you can't see the extent to which your wounds have healed until individuals start picking at them, right? So you might think it's healed. You find yourself in a certain situation and realize, no, this is a serious issue.
I want to offer just a few seconds here for you, Dr. Bruce, to offer a final thought as we're wrapping up this conversation and you send us out into that good night. What's on your mind about how we might be able to understand or move forward?
I hold on to the optimism that is echoed here in terms of quality conversation that acknowledges that there is a problem, also acknowledges that maybe the divides aren't as deep as we realize. But I would also just call out the fact that deep inequality still exists in our society, and to the extent that people have unequal access to power and privilege and a voice in politics or otherwise, then we're going to still see people clamoring to be a part of the game and part of the conversation.
Okay. Dr. Tricia Bruce, we heard from just a moment ago, their associate professor of sociology at Maryville College. She was joined by one of her Maryville colleagues, associate professor of history, Aaron Astor, and of course, Courtney Wright, associate professor of communication studies here at the University of Tennessee. Thank you all for being with us today for an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who called in today as well. We had some wonderful questions. Thanks to our call screener, Greg Hill, who's also our producer on the other side of the glass. And stay tuned next for Afternoon Concert with Garrett McQueen. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News.